From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide, and it's available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
These are John's final words. Fellow Americans, that association has meant more to me than any other. I lived and died a proud American. We have always had so much more in common with each other than in disagreement. If only we remember that and give each other the benefit of the presumption that we all love our country, we will get through these challenging times. We will come through them stronger than before. We always do.
As fast as things are moving these days, it already seems a long time ago that the nation laid to rest Senator John McCain. But both the legacy and the symbolism of a long and patriotic career shouldn't disappear in the noise of the moment, and we'll talk about what many are seeing as the end of an era with a guest who knew the senator and has reflected deeply on his passing, Rabbi Jack Moline.
Vice President-elect Pence, we welcome you and we truly thank you for joining us here at Hamilton and American Musical. We really do. We are the diverse America who are alarmed and anxious that your new administration will not protect us. Our planet, or defend us and uphold our inalienable rights, sir. But we truly hope that this show has inspired you to uphold our American values and to work on behalf of all of us. All of us.
That's how the cast of the hit musical Hamilton addressed audience member and Vice President-elect Mike Pence on November 19, 2016. How has the upheaval of our national culture impacted Broadway and the performing arts community since then? On this week's show, I'll ask theater writer and historian Robert Viagas. But first,
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized to ask a question before we proceed. The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with my colleague, Senator Harris. Mr. Chairman,
Judge
we
Kavanaugh,
received 42,000 documents that we haven't
and
been
everyone
able
else joining
to review
us
last
today.
Night, and we believe this hearing should
I know
be postponed.
This is an exciting day
what a dilemma
for all of you
the here. Democratic senators on the Judiciary Committee faced this week.
Be recognized, I move to
on
reserve.
The one hand, a business-as-usual approach would seem to legitimize the unprecedented violation of process that the majority perpetrated with its humiliating treatment of Judge Merrick Garland, as well as of the secrecy that has shrouded crucial parts of Judge Brett Kavanaugh's record. On the other hand, attempts at sounding the alarm and raising public awareness runs the very real risk of appearing petty and obstructionist and ultimately of having voters throw up their hands in exasperation. To help us sort through what's happened during the hearings, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Jay Michelson, who has written about them for the Daily Beast. Just one caveat, we're speaking on Thursday, well before the scheduled end of the Kavanaugh hearings. And with that said, Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Walton. It's good to be here.
What are your thoughts about the way the minority and the majority have been acting?
So it's a tricky question because it is definitely the case that Democrats are not behaving the way that senators usually do. So at the opening of the hearings, they interrupted Chuck Grassley, the Judiciary Committee chairman. You know, they're saying this is out of order. Today, on Thursday, Senator Booker released documents that he was explicitly told not to release. You know, but I think that has to be put into the context of the fact that the Democrats really have no other tools. They don't have the vote. And so their tactics are really limited. And I think they know, you know, just certainly very well that, in a way, this has to be tried in the court of public opinion. And the only way that a couple of, you know, that ultimately a few Republican senators, two or three, have to be swayed. And the only way that's really going to happen is if there's sufficient outrage around this nomination. And so they're doing anything they can to generate that outrage. I think today's email being released may do just that. I guess the real answer there is just desperate times call for desperate action. You know, in terms of how the majority is acting, they have all the cards. And I think really the Republicans are acting exactly the way they should. I said a moment ago, this is payback time. Like, this is mm-hmm. why so many Republican senators have put up with a president whom they can't stand and who they have serious issues with, as we saw in the op-ed in the New York Times this week. You know, it's not just liberals who are concerned about Donald Trump. It's conservatives as well, but they've kind of held their nose and put up with it for all this time for this moment. Mm-hmm. This is why they've done all of this work, so that they can swing the Supreme Court to the right. So it seems very unlikely that Republicans who have waited for 2 years or 18 months, let's say, of through the Trump administration just to get to this moment are now going to back off, when they have this kind of nominee.
Jay, in the first couple of days, what has stood out for you as most significant so far?
On the hearings on Wednesday, Senator Leahy picked up a scandal which nobody really remembers from 2003, which involved the theft of some documents from the server of the Judiciary Committee. Some of the documents were his own staff memos, so he has a particular kind of dog in this hunt. We don't really know who saw those documents back in 2003. Judge Kavanaugh at the time was working in the Bush White House. He said he hadn't seen the documents in sworn depositions. But yesterday, he kind of hedged and hemmed and hawed. He said, well, I can't remember if I've met with the guy who stole the documents. Well, that's basically saying he has. He would have clearly denied that. And obviously, he's prepared for this moment. His job used to be preparing people to be in nomination hearings. Then he said, well, maybe I received some of these stolen documents, but I wouldn't know that they were stolen documents. But that's really hard to believe. And if you're looking at internal staff memoranda, you know that they've been, you know, you're not supposed to be seeing them. You know, internal memos from the other side with very direct notes about what their strategy is. So, if it's true that some of these censored emails can prove, the way that Senator Leahy says they can prove that Judge Kavanaugh received these documents back in 2003, should have known that they were stolen, that means that he's lied under oath.
Mm-hmm.
He committed perjury twice in his 2006 confirmation to be a judge and now again in 2018. That, to me, was very surprising. That's what jumps out at me the most. Not the sort of bells and whistles and not the evasions on Roe versus Wade. I think we expected all of that. But that was kind of a bombshell yesterday. I wrote an article about it in the Daily Beast just on that particular issue. The scandal was called Memogate, which makes it easy to remember and to search. And I think this could be a real kind of dark horse issue that if it's true, and it's a big if the emails that have been censored prove Senator Leahy right, that Judge Kavanaugh knew about these stolen documents, that's a huge issue, and I think it's something to pay attention to in the coming days.
Who makes the decision about that?
Well, that's the thing. So, you know, Senator Grassley makes the decision about it. He basically has unlimited authority to say what's confidential and what's not. Today, Thursday, Senator Booker took the very unusual step of releasing some of those confidential emails as, again, a sort of act of desperation to say, look, these emails aren't confidential. You just don't want people to see them. That's a huge departure from Senate rules. You know, I think I would expect Senator Booker to be possibly censured for doing that. But it does reveal that these emails that are being censored are not being censored for security reasons. They're being censored because Senator Grassley or others don't want people to see what's in them. And these the emails around – so Senator Grassley said he will release the emails. There are apparently five or six emails in particular about Memogate. He has not done so far. And that's just unreviewable. There's no recourse. There's no accountability. If Senator Grassley goes back on his word and doesn't release those emails, there's really nothing that anyone can do other than what Senator Booker just did, which is just release them himself.
I want you to talk about how different this process has been from its predecessors. Even when someone like Judge Bork was put forward, was the process as partisan as this one has been?
I think Judge Bork was the only one that was close to this partisan until, of course, Judge Garland. But that really is before and after. You know, it's not, despite some people's selective amnesia, we can't forget the events of 2016, where a fully qualified nominee was not even given a hearing. So we're all reaping what we sow, and the Republicans are reaping in the discord that we're seeing. They're reaping what they sowed a couple of years ago. You know, I think a lot of the nominees, you know, have been kind of had been over the years kind of consensus picks. So when you look at Chief Justice Roberts, for example, there was fierce opposition there, but not to the level that we see now. Even Justice Alito, who is more conservative than Chief Justice Roberts, but. You know, first of all, we have an illegitimate president. Second of all, with the election itself being disputed because it was affected by a foreign power. Second, we've got Judge Garland in the background. And third, we now have two extremely conservative nominees, not folks who are in the middle of the mainstream or even to the right of the mainstream, but folks who are way outside the mainstream, both Judge Gorsuch and Judge Kavanaugh. And the fact that Judge Gorsuch seems like a nice guy and Judge Kavanaugh is very intelligent and competent is beside the point. The fact is this process is very, very different from anything that we saw prior to Judge Garland's non-confirmation.
I want to ask one question because it is about religious liberty, and that is one of our primary issues. Senator Ted Cruz spent some time questioning the nominee on religious liberty. I had two questions. One, was there anything noteworthy in what he said? But even bigger than that, what kind of religious freedom were they talking about? There are two definitions.
They were talking about what I called, you know, religious freedom in scare quotes, meaning it's the freedom to use religion to take away another person's rights.
Right.
As you know, we've talked about this many times. That's a very different and recent definition or redefinition of religious liberty from the one that we've had in our country for over 200 years. It's interesting. When Judge Kavanaugh's name was floated, he was not the most right-wing on social issues of the various nominees. Potential nominees that the Trump administration was considering. And there was some ambivalence about it. In fact, you know, so I receive emails from right and left. I get all kinds of hard right-wing fundraising emails, things like that for my work. And the American Family Association actually put out an email saying, well, we may not agree with Judge Kavanaugh on everything, but he's still a good guy, meaning he's not as far right as they'd like. And that's what Senator Cruz was, his line of questioning was about. It's all harping on a couple of sentences, really, in one opinion that Judge Kavanaugh wrote, where he said, well, the government has a compelling state interest in providing access to contraception, but it's not narrowly tailored enough to pass muster. Just admitting that there is actually an interest was enough to raise flags on the hard right, and this is on the religious right. So I think the questioning was basically about that. But the religious right needn't worry. There are numerous other examples where Judge Kavanaugh has towed the line. Just one example, in discussing an abortion case, he used the phrase abortion on demand. That's almost like a dog whistle to the religious right. That's a phrase that only folks on the religious right use to talk about access to reproductive health care, so abortion on demand. So there were plenty of other They needn't worry. But it is true, I think it's a footnote to the main story, but it is true that there are folks on the religious right who are not as happy with this pick as others were.
Well, paying attention to this hearing has been disturbing for me, and I think it's been disturbing for other people as well. And it leads me to ask you a very blunt question. Has the process just broken down completely? Are these elected representatives just going through the motions at this point?
That is a tough question. You know, I think without getting too spiritual about it, but getting a little spiritual about it, you know, the 2016 was a real wound, the Garland non-confirmation. Obviously, the election was also, but I focused on this process, on judicial confirmation, and it has not been healed. There has not been even an admission that what happened was wrong. It's been sort of forgotten on the right, and you know, they're hoping that we can all just forget about it and move on, but that's not going to happen. And as long as the Supreme Court remains affected by the events of 2016, you know, when a fully qualified nominee wasn't even voted on, and he may not have won nomination. I mean, he may well have lost, you know, in a confirmation vote. But to not even go through the motions, so to speak, that's not going to, you know, that doesn't go away. It mm-hmm. also doesn't go away when the nomination is held in secrecy, as this one is, unlike every other one in the past, including Judge Bork. And it's not going to go away when a sitting president is an unindicted co-conspirator for federal crimes. That just doesn't, it beggars the imagination why, you know, if you were looking objectively, why this nomination is happening. So, you know, in a strange way, I mean, Judge Kavanaugh has one thing in common with Judge Garland. They both sit on the D.C. Circuit, of course. But what they have in common is these are both good people who are in the middle of a really kind of disgusting situation. And where you lie, I put the blame pretty much on one side, but even if you don't do that, it's certainly the case that the process is not where it should be. I would say one other thing. You know, a lot of folks on the left are wondering, well, what can we do? Should we call our senators? Should we go to the streets and protest? You know, I'm kind of from the school of hard knocks on this one. You know, what we can do is make sure to vote in elections. Lindsey Graham and I don't agree on much, but he is correct that elections matter. And these are the consequences of elections. When progressives don't rank the Supreme Court among their top two or three issues, mm-hmm. and conservatives do, that's going to have effects. That's going to have consequences. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, in 2016, certainly for religious right, Supreme Court was, you know, either the number one or number two issue for religious conservative voters. When you look on the progressive side, religious and secular alike, the Supreme Court was toward the bottom of the issues that people asked about, you know, number 10, 11, 12. So that's an issue. And when folks decided that, you know, they didn't like the presidential candidate in 2016 enough to go vote for her, well, this, you reap what you sow. And so in a certain way, it's too late to take a lot of meaningful action. It's not helpful to call other people senators and register your opinion. So it really only matters if you're from Alaska or Maine, since those are the two states that where senators are still up in question. The ship has sailed. This is the consequence of not placing the Supreme Court at the top of our priority list, and hopefully in 2018 it will be.
Dr. J. Michelson is a rabbi, an author, activist, and attorney who is also the legal affairs columnist for the Daily Beast. Jay is an affiliated assistant professor at Chicago Theological Seminary, and his books range from The Essential God versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, to The Gate of Tears, Sadness and the Spiritual Path. Jay, it's always great to welcome you to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend. I appreciate that.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline. And up next, the impact of a changing world on the performing arts community. We'll hear from Broadway historian Robert Viagas. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. It's been 6 years since Robert Viagas last appeared on this program. At that time, a seemingly more and more progressive and inclusive nation was seeing a number of religion-themed productions on The Great White Way. Oh my, how things have changed, or that's my perspective. Today, the political religious right is ascendant and is exercising its power in ways that impact every part of our society. And with that as a backdrop, I'm happy to welcome Robert Viagas back to State of Belief Radio. Robert, thanks for being with us again.
It is a pleasure to be back. It is lovely to be on Broadway, and it is lovely to be on your show.
How do you see things now?
Well, I have to tell you that the theater people tend to be very religious. I mean, that may not be their image. There may not be the cliche that is imposed on them, but a lot of them are very, very religious. For instance, there is a lot of praying that goes on backstage during the time when Hamilton first opened. Chris Jackson, who played Washington, he used to lead the cast actually in a prayer circle before the show. They may still indeed do that. Although there's no revival of Godspell currently on Broadway, a lot of the shows do discuss religion. They discuss morality. There's a lot of things that are not necessarily mentioning any particular deity, although Jesus Christ is in fact a character in one of the shows in the Book of Mormon, actually appears on stage with Crown of Thorns and all. In fact, there's a lot of interesting things that are going on. For instance, last year's Tony Award winner, Dear Evan Hansen, mm-hmm. It doesn't really mention God specifically, but that show is a parable just like any in the Bible. It's really about, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. A boy tells a lie, and the lie kind of snowballs, and it eventually involves his whole community, his whole family, the family of somebody who's passed away. And it's really about what's right, what ultimately is moral in a situation like that. And that's really, I find things like that, and there's a lot of examples like that, I find that to be really interesting. That there's like this moral universe, and I mean, that's part of what theater has always done. Questioned and explored the moral universe, and a lot of those issues move over into the world of religion.
That being said, how is all of this being impacted by not just the culture, but the politics that are always with us from various perspectives? How much is that affecting Broadway?
Well, somebody once told me, and I thought this was very funny, that Broadway musicals are an art form created by liberals for the entertainment of conservatives. and certainly, though, I'm going to jump back to Hamilton. At the end of a performance of Hamilton during the presidential campaign, then vice presidential candidate Mike Pence was in the audience. And at the end of the show, they actually stopped the show and lectured him, which was incredibly bold on their part. So I find that, of course, a lot of the people, but not all, a lot of the people who work on Broadway and who create for Broadway tend to be opposed to what's happening in Washington right now, if that's the question that you have. But again, the shows themselves often deal with bigger questions.
Do you see any or hear any divisiveness within the people who are doing these shows, or are they pretty unanimous in their feelings toward the current administration?
I would say that overwhelmingly they are opposed what's happening, because a lot of what we're hearing tends to be against diversity of all kinds, whereas the theater tends to celebrate diversity. So it's very hard to reconcile those things, but there are people who do feel that the current administration and the party, his supporters, his many, many voters, that they're on the wrong path, and that they want to set our country on the wrong path. And so I would say that in general is the case, but we haven't seen, like, for instance, when George Bush was president, there was actually a show making fun of George Bush. We haven't yet seen an anti-Trump show. I have a feeling that history is not going to be terribly kind to the president, and so those things may come. I mean, just think about the movies and the TV series and the novels and the – I mean, we're already seeing nonfiction books and things like that. But our era is going to be written about for decades to come, and we're in the midst of history. And I think that the theater will eventually deal with it in that way too.
Would you say that art is reflecting life right now, or would that be a misnomer?
Yes. Well, a lot of these are questions that are eternal questions. These are questions that were troubling the apostles. These are questions that were troubling people in the Middle Ages. You know, what's right and what's wrong? How do I live in the real world and yet follow the rules that God has laid down for us? There's big issues that are constantly dealt with. And of course, you know, theater grew out of religion. Right. Theater grew out of church. If you think about it, the church services are very theatrical in many ways. And theater kind of grew out of that, and it still deals with those issues. The best theater still deals with those gigantic issues.
Do you see, Robert, because you've got a long perspective on this, do you see things changing on Broadway, or is it pretty much the same and just different shows?
Broadway itself specifically has changed a great deal. The neighborhood has changed, and I think it has changed the kind of people who are attracted to come to see Broadway shows. I mean, there was a period of time when it was dangerous to go into the theater district, where you would be, could be robbed. You would be approached by prostitutes. It was not a family-friendly place. When I first became interested in the theater, you would go despite those things. But a lot of those things have been cleaned up, and it attracts a different audience. And for that audience, they have been creating different shows. I mean, there's a whole movement of, teenage girls. So many of the shows are oriented towards, whether it's Wicked or Anastasia or Aladdin. A lot of these shows are oriented towards teenage girls or girls in their 20s. Millennials, really. We have a whole millennial generation that grew up with musicals in the form of Disney movies. Those Disney movies were all, whether it was Little Mermaid or Beauty and the Beast or Aladdin, these were all things that were created essentially by Broadway people. And the kids who are now in their 20s all grew up with this. And so they had High School Musical, and they had Glee, and they had so many of these things that was just this very Broadway sensibility that was kind of just part of their lives. And so Broadway has adapted to that and is creating shows that entertain that audience. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to me. Unfortunately, because their upbringing was so oriented towards musicals, that tends to be what they go to see. And sometimes dramas do not get the same attention that they once got. But, you know, as I said, these are, you know, issues of inclusivity and, you know, issues of women not being subservient to men. Right. Issues of diversity, you know, the fact that you don't just see white faces on Broadway anymore. You see a much greater diversity of faces among actors and even among writers. They're creating a different theater. And I think that is all because the audience that is now gradually taking control were kind of raised in this environment where they learned from, as I said, those Disney movies and the shows that imitated them.
Robert, I've been wanting to ask you for a long time, what happened with Hamilton? What was it about that show that just captivated so many people?
Well, you know, for a long time, Broadway music has reflected a push and a pull between classical, like opera, and whatever was the pop music of the time. I mean, you look at the Gershwins, you look at Richard Rodgers, they were taking basically an operatic form, but they were infusing it with popular music. At a certain point in about the 50s and 60s, Broadway kind of acquired its own sound, like a that people associate with Broadway, like a Hello Dolly sort of a sound, that became the Broadway sound. And popular music was moving beyond that. And Broadway, there was a period of time where Broadway did not keep up with popular music. To some degree, it did, like Andrew Lloyd Webber and Bublil and Schomburg, who wrote Les Mis, and people like that. They infused musical theater with popular music. But it wasn't until really recently that, for example, Hamilton finally returned that push and pull that I was talking about. They take this operatic form and they use rap and they use soul and they use all these popular musics that were kind of ignored for a while. And that is what people love about musical theater. And I think it was that sound and the fact that it's connected with the popular culture that appealed to people, even though it was about this guy who lived more than 200 years ago. It almost didn't matter. I mean, it was a compelling story as well, although Hamilton is, he's not a perfect character. But I think the fact that it spoke in the vernacular, which is what musical theater had always done at its best, that I think made it so popular.
When you go to Broadway, it seems to me you have a chance to see something that is engaging and relevant, but you also have the opportunity for evasiveness and retreat. Would that be true?
Well, right now I think people are so overwhelmed. I mean, there's something new every single day. Some new awful thing comes out every single day. So I think to a certain degree, like binge watching Netflix and things like that, mm-hmm. I think people do want to kind of evade that, or just have a respite, just have a little rest from all the awful things that are going on. But I think the theater tends to deal with bigger questions. I mean, look at the incredible success of the Harry Potter show, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. There are religious people who feel that it, celebrates black magic. But it's interesting, when J.K. Rowling wrote those books, she never really deals overtly with God and religion. Mm-hmm. And of course, black magic is evil, but she's created this space between it of white magic. Witches and wizards. I mean, you talk about a witch, they burned witches not that long ago. Witches and wizards who work for good. And it's never mentioned specifically. God is not mentioned specifically, but it's implicit. Because like, where does this magic come from? Who created this world? Who created the good and bad, black and white magic? So a lot of these things are implicit in that world. And again, we're talking about characters who are dealing with what is right, what is wrong, what is moral, what is immoral. They're really dealing with religious questions without specifically, mentioning a particular deity. But it's there in what they're talking about. And I think that affects people's attitudes. I mean, what's the things that are going on in Washington? There are some people think that it is terrible and that it's awful. And there are some people who think that what he's doing is great. They think he's doing a fantastic job. And each side cannot believe that the other side could possibly believe what they believe. That is just such an interesting thing. That is such an interesting aspect of the age in which we live. And I think that is something that is going to be dealt with by our arts, by theater, and in many, many ways in the decades to come.
Robert Viagas is a theater historian, founder of Playbill.com, and has almost 20 books on the performing arts to his name, including The Backstage Guide to Broadway and The Alchemy of Theater. Keep up the good work, and I hope that we'll talk again, and it won't be so long before we do that.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir.
In addition to the various crises and controversies generated by the Trump administration, the month of August ended with a moving farewell to Senator John McCain. At a time when most political leaders seem to be trapped in unthinking partisan lockstep, the former POW seemed more bound to his conscience and his constituents than to the GOP. And ironically, a notoriously curmudgeon has become a symbol for bipartisanship and civility. With insights that span both the personal and the policy issues currently on the table, I'm happy to welcome Interfaith Alliance President Rabbi Jack Moline back to State of Belief Radio. Jack, thanks for being with us again.
I always look forward to these visits, Welton.
Do you see the passing of John McCain as a watershed moment for our nation politically and or culturally?
Oh, I'm always reluctant to call something a watershed when I'm right on top of it. But I think it certainly served to remind people that things were not always the way they are right now. I was talking with some of my friends about back when you and I were children and President Kennedy was assassinated and what that weekend of grieving did to an America that was ebullient at that moment. I mean, we thought the world was our oyster and suddenly we were plunged into depression and we recovered, but there were tough times afterwards. This in a lot of ways seems like exactly the opposite time. Things are so fractious in this country. There is such disregard for people in political leadership and there's such a lack of ability to get things done for the betterment of the people of this country. And then with the death of John McCain, we were suddenly reminded that the times we thought were a little difficult behind us were really not so bad. We got to hear from people from at least three different administrations who brought us back to the notion that even when there was disagreement, there was a way for that disagreement to be skillfully and constructively articulated so that we could all engage in these conversations. And I think Senator McCain recognized in Secretary of State Kissinger, in President Obama, and in President Bush, people who could articulate those visions again for America and give us a sense that maybe things will be okay again.
The kind of bipartisanship that John McCain represented and practiced is endangered right now.
Oh, it's absolutely endangered. Look, John McCain was a Republican. There wasn't any question that he would ever caucus with Democrats or independents or anybody else. But he always put country above party, and he always put his values above whatever the political play of the moment was. And I have to say, I didn't always agree with those values, but he was very direct about them right up front. And he was willing to engage on those values. And most importantly, he recognized that he wasn't the sole possessor of truth and rectitude. Mm-hmm. And for all of his thin-skinned nature and what was reputed to be a very quick temper, he was a man who had deep respect for disagreement, especially if it was disagreement on principle and not simply for the sake of amassing power.
Yeah. With things changing so quickly these days, is there a McCain legacy that you could identify?
Well, I wish I could. I think John McCain came of age politically at a time when the values that he held were not uncommon. And therefore, the fact that he sort of the last of that generation makes him seem iconic when he might simply have been more typical. I don't know who that person or who those people are in the time coming up. I'd like to think that there are some people who are seeing this as an opportunity to set a new standard or return to a better standard, but I'd be hard-pressed to identify who they are right now. And I say that in spite of the fact that I have a deep personal affection for some people in government, elected officials who are friends of mine and who I think have the potential to be that kind of person, but they're not there yet.
Without betraying confidences, are any of them increasingly alarmed at what has entered the public discourse? And if not, What are they counting on to keep the ship of state afloat?
So I certainly have more friends on one side of the aisle than the other, but I'm not without my contacts on both sides. Mm-hmm. I will tell you that my impression of people who go into politics and seek elected office is that overwhelmingly, and I really mean overwhelmingly, they are people of good values. They're people with a deep love for this country, and they want to see the right thing done. The ideologues get a lot of attention, but there are far fewer of them than most people believe, particularly in the Senate and the Congress. Everybody I know is appalled by the tenor of discourse in this country. And everybody I know is alarmed to see that partisan gain, or in the case I think of the president, personal gain, is being put above what's in the best interests of the country. There is not a one of them yet willing to risk their seat to step up and say the right things about people on both sides of the aisle. And that is, it's a disappointment to me, and more of a disappointment because I know those sentiments are there.
Yeah.
They weren't there, it would be a pox on everybody's house. But those sentiments are there, and I hope someone will break through and allow that moment to occur, because I think the floodgates will be opened.
Yeah.
Jack, a few weeks ago, the President of the United States staged what many called a state dinner for religious rights supporters. What was the reaction from Interfaith Alliance to that?
Well, of course, we were very concerned. President Trump is not the first president to invite religious leaders into the White House. And certainly every president has leaned on religious leaders who are more supportive and less critical. So that part of it was not surprising. But the uniformity and the political extremism of the pastors and leaders who were invited to the White House is something that I've never seen before. Mm-hmm. And we express concern about that. These are, many of them, the same people who are on his so-called Faith Advisory Committee, which consists entirely of people with a right-wing political and religious perspective from within a certain flavor of evangelical Christianity. And the fact that he offered this dinner of appreciation to them, and it may just be me noticing it, but in the month leading up to the deadline by which the special prosecutor could announce results until after the election, it just seems to me to be a little suspicious and a little dishonest.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but ask, with little news coverage, do unprecedented potential church-state disasters like this hold the promise to fundamentally undermine the way of a government functions and whose interest it prioritizes?
I think in most circumstances, Welton, I would answer that question yes. I don't know what circumstances we're in right now. I know that if the people who were at that dinner suddenly decided that they were going to be critical of the president for his personal behavior or for his policies, they would suddenly find themselves uninvited to the White House. So as long as he sees any group as his base, I think he will cater to them. And if his goal is to remain in office and to establish a reputation for himself rather than to do what's right for the country, he will follow support wherever it leads him. It's an awful thing to say about someone, but it appears to me to be true. There are lots of people in faith communities, not as far left as I am, who are willing to advise him, as we have been with President Clinton, President Bush, President Obama. And the current president of the United States seems uninterested in anyone who will not offer a hagiographic take on his presidency. these particular pastors have sold their soul for a fish dinner at the White House.
So, Jack, would you take a minute or two to talk about the kind of person you've seen getting involved with Interfaith Alliance in recent months and why they see value in supporting your work?
Let me tell you a quick story, Welton, about a check that we received from a woman named Ada in New York. I don't want to identify her without her permission. And I won't tell you the amount of money she gave us, though it was a significantly larger gift than we had received from her in the past. And on the check was written, in memory of, and then the name of a gentleman who did not have the same last name. So I was curious, and I called her up and I asked her what was behind all of this. She said this was a man who had become a friend of hers and her husband's, they spent many happy years in friendship with this man and his family, and he died. And she wanted to do something that she felt would be meaningful. So she sent us a large check in his memory. And I said to her, how did you decide on Interfaith Alliance? Of all of the organizations that must have been available to you, why us? She said, I can't think of anybody who's doing more important work than you are.
Mm.
I was really very touched by that.
Mm-hmm.
Then I will tell you, I had an opportunity to be reviewing the interview that you did with Walter Cronkite many years ago when he became so involved in our organization. And you asked him the question that I asked Ada, and he gave the same answer.
Mm.
I can't think of anything more important. So I'm really glad that what we're doing has succeeded in making that message vibrant over a generation already.
Jack, there'll never be a time when your voice is not important on this radio show. Jack Moline is president of Interfaith Alliance, protecting true religious freedom for all. And I thank you again today for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion that is going on there. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.